Good morning, everyone. We are reading in Book 6, the Book of Fate, Canto 2, The Way of Fate and the Problem of Pain. And we've reached page 451. I think we stopped at the break. So we're deep in the problem of pain. Narad has been replying to the questions of Savitri's mother about the mystery of grief and pain. How can this have come into our world? And in the last two sections, he has spoken about the sufferings of the Son of God, those who come missioned with some great task to uplift humanity. And we ended the previous section with one of Sri Aurobindo's prophecies. Here and there in the poem, he speaks about the fulfillment when all this work will be done. He speaks about a world on the borders of the meeting of all worlds, where the secret law of each thing is fulfilled and all contraries heal their long dissidence. All these opposites become reconciled. This is the supramental world where the secret law of each thing is fulfilled. And he described how pain there becomes a violent, fiery joy, and evil turns back to its original good, and even sorrow lies upon the breasts of bliss. And he says, then shall be ended here the law of pain. Earth shall be made a home of heaven's light. A seer, heaven-born, shall lodge in human breasts. The superconscient beam shall touch men's eyes, and the truth-conscious world come down to earth, invading matter with the spirit's ray, awaking its silence to immortal thoughts, awaking the dumb heart to the living word. This mortal life shall house eternity's bliss, the body's self taste immortality. Then shall the world redeemer's task be done. That is the fulfillment of all these many world redeemers who have come and suffered to carry the whole process forward. So then Narad continues with some advice for us. Manoha, will you begin?
He then must life carry its seed of death and sorrows plain to be heard in the slow night. O mortal, bear this great world's law of pain in thy hard passage through a suffering world. Lean for thy soul's support on heaven's strength. turn towards high truths, aspire to love and peace. A little bliss is lent thee from above, a touch divine upon thy human ways. Make of thy daily way a pilgrimage, for through small joys and griefs thou movest towards God.
Thank you. Nothing to say,
it's
no?
Still there.
Very nice. Make of thy daily way a pilgrimage.
What I find interesting for me is also lean for thy soul support and heaven's strength, and to aspire to always to something higher.
Yes. If we remember that yeah. High truth is there, yeah. that omnipresent reality is there, when things are difficult, we can turn for support to that. And maybe we can learn to feel that support with us more and more in our everyday life by making our daily way a pilgrimage. When we're on a pilgrimage, we know things are going to be tough, that it's difficult, no? But we accept those difficulties because we are on our way to some special destination that we've decided to make the necessary effort to reach it. We expect to receive blessings at the end. But then he gives some quite different advice. You will read, Amitaj.
Haste not towards Godhead on a dangerous road. Open not thy doorways to a nameless heart. Climb not to Godhead by the Titan's road. Against the law he pits his single will. Across its way he throws his pride of might. Heavenward he clambers on still of storm, aspiring to live near the deathless sun. He strives with a giant strength to wrest by force from life and nature the immortal's right. He takes by storm the world and fate and heaven. He comes not to the high world maker's seat. He waits not for the outstretched hand of God to raise him out of his mortality.
Thank you. Anything to ask or to share about this passage? Yes, Tom.
I'm inquisitive about the title. Yeah. We make our pilgrimage every day. We pilgrimage on to aspire for God and so on. And
who is this Titan?
Who is this Titan? Yeah. Not nice, that's for sure.
In Savitri, Sri Aurobindo uses this word Titan as an equivalent of the word Asura, or sometimes maybe even Rakshasa. The Rakshasa is more the vital ego, and the Asura more the mental ego. At the time when Sri Aurobindo was writing Savitri, there were several great Asuras inhabiting or manipulating human beings on Earth. No? One of them was Hitler, another was Stalin, perhaps Franco and Mussolini were lesser ones. No? And Mother has spoken about them in one of her prayers and meditations. No? They have come, these powers have come with ambition to I should find the exact words. I don't want to misquote now. But because of these titanic influences, Sri Aurobindo and the mother had to, for a time, set aside their work on the transformation to concentrate on saving the world from the influence of these big beings. Moshe Aubindo said that if they are not defeated, that will set the whole evolution of humanity back, perhaps by 1,000 years or more, if they would be dominate the earth. So later on in this passage, he describes what that domination is like. But they also had experience of human beings who opened themselves to those titanic forces out of ambition, even spiritual ambition. No. So that is what he's warning against here. Don't be so eager for high realizations that you open yourself to these powerful forces. They may seem very attractive and impressive and convincing, full of light. They can present themselves like that, full of light. But they don't reach to the Lord's seat, no? Comes not to the high world maker's seat. No.
Shradhavan, how do we discern that what is pushing us is towards even spirituality? It is not the titan and it is the positive force. Because we want to go along on the path, whatever.
Yes. So that's why Mother suggests to us to try to become very aware of the different parts of our being. If we can distinguish those impulses that come to us, perhaps with a lot of enthusiasm through the vital, that make a lot of clamor and noise and say, you have to do this. If we could distinguish this from that still, quiet voice of the psychic, which is always turning us towards the sunlight of the truth, even in a very quiet, humble way, maybe. So she says that's why sincerity is needed, so that you can begin to know yourself and be able to distinguish these things. And to Huta, she gave her just a kind of little indication. She said, usually the truth is leading towards more harmony, and the opposite forces, they want to create more disorder and disharmony. So that's perhaps one criterion that one can follow.
Well, harmony doesn't mean compromise.
Yes, sometimes we wonder whether we have to compromise in order to keep harmony. So I think this is something within ourselves. No? Can you feel harmony in yourself about what you have to do and to say? If you've got a very clear indication from your soul, then you may, in a quite harmonious, quiet way. I have seen my beloved teacher Amal do this sometimes. You know, so quietly, he says, you know. But he was absolutely sure about what he had to say and do. So that quiet strength can come from the soul.
Sometimes you need discordance to know that there is harmony. To have everything perfect, and then the fact that you are perfect.
You cannot ensure that everything is perfect. The whole world is full of all these contrary forces.
I'm saying that it has a purpose.
But it's like there's a little silver thread. If we can find that and hold on to it, it leads us through all kinds of... Anyway, make of thy daily way a pilgrimage. There may be clashes and difficulties and challenges on the way, but if you know why, what you are following, and then the element of surrender comes in instead of asserting your own will and your own conception about how things should be. Sometimes we just have to dissolve all our thought formations, you know, and listen and find out, and then we may get an indication of something completely unexpected, an unexpected solution or direction. So, and he's here, he's describing to us the Titan, that we can recognize him, no? He pits his single will, his own individual will, against the universal law of truth and light. And across the way of that law of progress and growing light, he throws his own pride of might. He feels so strong, and I will have things my own way. And he may feel that he wants to reach a very high level because there's power, but he's going by a path of storm. He wants to live near that deathless sun, to have that power and influence and light and all the rest of it. But he's trying to do it by force, to wrest by force from life and nature the right of the immortals. He takes by storm the world and fate and heaven. And he doesn't wait for God to stretch out his hand and raise him up. So the description continues. Shall we go on? Mihong.
All he would make his own, living nothing free, stretching his small self to cope with the infinite, abstracting the vast open ways he makes his own estate of the earth, air, and light. A monopolized of the world energy, he dominates the life of common men. His pain and others' pain, he makes his means. On death and suffering, he builds his throne. In the hurry and the clangor of his acts of might, in a riot and excess of fame and shame. By his malignant use of hate and violence, by the quaking of the world beneath his tread, he matches himself against the eternal calm and feels in himself the greatness of a god. Power is his image of the celestial self.
Thank you. So we can recognize them. No? There are big ones and there are little ones. But this impulse of domination, of power. Shall we read on?
The Titan's heart is a sea of fire and force. He exults in the death of things and wind and force. He feels his strength with his own and others' pain. In the world's battles and passion, he takes delight. His pride, his mire call for the struggle and pain. He glories in the sufferings of the flesh and covers the stigmata of the Stoic's name. His eyes blinded and visionless stare at the sun, the seeker's sight receding from his heart and find no more of the light of eternity. He sees the beyond as an emptiness void of soul and takes his knife of the dark. A dark infinite. His nature magnifies the envious man and sees in more the soul behind him. He will stand as a single figure in the world, possess the world's governance with his single name. His moments stand up revives in us. He sees his little cells as very long. His little eye has swallowed the whole world. His ego has stretched into infinity.
Thank you. There are not only political ambitions, there are also spiritual ambitions. Sri Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita warns us against torturing the body in the name of spiritual ambition. Because he says it's the divine you himself that you are torturing. So there's something in that movement of ambition that may glory in the sufferings of the flesh. Can't hear you.
In the world's pathos, compassion, what is pathos?
Pathos is what makes us feel sympathy, suffering. It covers the stigmata with the Stoic's name. The stigmata are the marks of the nails in Christ's hands and feet and the side where the spear went in. And there have been mystics who have experienced these things in their own body. Yes,
Saint
Francis had it, and there was a German mystic, Teresa von Neumann.
Teresa von Konnersworth.
She was experiencing it daily. He doesn't seem to be encouraging that. And the Stoic, of course, is one who undertakes a discipline to bear all suffering without revolt and overreaction. But Stoicism is different. Stoicism doesn't ask for the suffering. It doesn't court it. No, the idea of the Stoic is that whatever comes to you in life, good or bad, you should be able to take it with an equal. It's quite a good preparation for starting yoga if one can cultivate it. Then you have to go beyond that cultivation of equality. But you can cover these things of courting and calling for suffering under the name of the Stoic. And there are these ascetic disciplines, for instance, of gazing at the sun, starting in the early morning and when it's relatively easy, and keeping your eyes fixed on the sun all through the day, until maybe if you repeat it, you lose your sight completely and the eyes get completely damaged. So Narad is saying that is not a way to be followed, that kind of excessive asceticism. Yes, Don?
There's a very, very famous episode in the Buddha's life before he became the Buddha. He leaves the palace and he attempts asceticism along with others.
Yes.
We have statues where he is just a bag of bones, but then realizes that there's no power, there's no strength in that there, and that there is the best of the middle way.
Yes. And then Sri Aurobindo describes how if one follows this way, the inner sight of the soul, the seeker's sight, recedes, it withdraws, and so he can't see the light of eternity anymore. And he begins to perceive everything that is beyond this world just as an emptiness, a void. And this darkness of his, he thinks that's a dark infinite. He magnifies this unreal's blank, the asat, the emptiness, and sees in nothingness the soul reality. And so he thinks he has the right to stamp his own figure on that nothingness. And he wants everybody to know about him, to obsess the world's rumors with his single name. And he feels himself the center of the whole universe. So his ego has expanded unbelievably. Yeah. It's a description of spiritual ruin, actually. It's dreadful, dreadful. Would you read, please, Prashid?
His mind, the weakened original nothingness, ciphers his thought on a slate of powerless time. He builds on a mighty vacancy of soul, a rude philosophy of nothingness. In him, Nirvana moves and speaks and acts. Impossibly creating a universe, an eternal zero in his formless self, the spirit, the void, impersonal, absolute. Take not that stride, a growing soul of man. Ask not thyself into that night of God. The soul suffering is not eternity's key, ransomed by sorrow, heaven's demand on life, for mortal beer, not asked, not for stroke. Too soon will the grief and anguish find thee out.
Let's pause there. So. Bear the stroke, but don't ask for it.
I have something, how many ear, tear, beer, and then here, twice this morning they have read it as beer, and
oh,
bear.
It's bear, yes.
Yes.
Yes. Bear, oh mortal bear. It came before, no?
Yes.
What does he mean when he says nirvana? Well, nirvana, nothingness, can I say nothingness?
It's the destruction of all forms in a way.
The dissolution of all forms and movements and everything.
Everything is abolished. And once Mother remarked that Buddha was on the side of Shiva.
Yes.
That Buddha was, I'm sorry?
Of Shiva, not of Vishnu. Shiva is a destroyer, right?
Yeah.
He liberates by destruction.
Because bringing in the manifestation is a destructive action. Everything is abolished and destroyed.
Yes. So that can be liberating in the yoga process. That can be a deep liberation, so long as it is only one of the wings of the ascent, Sri Aurobindo says. The dissolution.
But it's not the unmanifest. Therefore, it is just the silence of the mind, I thought Sri Aurobindo experienced it, no?
Nirvana is a label that has been given perhaps by the Buddha himself. Of course, it's suggestive in Sanskrit. It's a state of nothingness, of no qualities, no movements, no forms. It's beyond all that.
It says here, in him Nirvana lives and speaks and acts impossibly.
Yes, so that's why it's a bit of a puzzle why Narad, why Sri Aurobindo is using this word here.
I think it's just a total silence.
Yes.
I'm wondering whether he's referring to the Buddha here. I mean, it sounds that way.
I don't think Sri Aurobindo or Narad were so negative about the Buddha. But it has a certain suggestion to us.
It is said that the Buddha, when asked what is nirvana, either refused, could not, or would not explain what it was.
No, it's impossible to explain what it is. Now you're asking me. So yes, Prasheed.
I think nirvana is in the context of moksha in
yes.
Indian philosophy. Moksha is essentially complete detachment in Aurobindo's way of yoga.
Yes. And it's very interesting that in our other class on Thursday, we've just been reading how Savitri experiences this state herself. No?
Yes.
And of the complete loss of sense of self, the feeling that at any moment the individual center of perception can disappear, that there's this nothingness. But at the same time, she is aware that beyond this state, there is some unknowable reality. And she is waiting for something to come from there. So I think this is, Sri Aurobindo refers to his first major spiritual experience as his nirvana experience. Sometimes he calls it that. That was my nirvana experience. Or he says, that was my experience of the silent Dhamma, which gives a sense of the absolute unreality of everything here. But then that experience was superseded by another one. But here in this context...
he's bragging.
Who is bragging?
The Titan.
The Titan. He says, I am
Nirvana.
Yeah, maybe that's it.
This passage is not complimenting.
I don't think it's bragging. I think it's that he was able to act. You know, Sri Aurobindo could speak also, but his mind was silent. He wasn't speaking from his mind.
No,
his
he
mind
felt.
Was silent, receiving from above.
He felt that a higher reality
yeah.
is speaking through him. Or that he says these two alternatives. Either it's there's some higher power acting through, or it is nature just going on its own way. But here this is something different, isn't it?
When Buddha was living and acting and speaking, was it Nirvana for speaking and acting?
Mm.
It would be no. It is through the body of Dharma, Dharmakaya.
Mm.
You can do that.
Mm.
Nirvana does not manifest.
Nirvana does not manifest.
It's kind of paradox.
Yes.
Mm. As if Nirvana itself was manifesting, which is an impossibility.
Yes. Impossibly creating a universe. But he's taking the credit. Well, the Titan takes the credit for it. So he warns us, take not that stride, O growing soul of man. Cast not thyself into that night of God. The soul suffering is not eternity's key, or ransom by sorrow heaven's demand on life. Mother has spoken about this in the context of Christianity, that there's the idea that the sufferings of Christ will ransom the world. And there's even some idea of the saints to emulate that. And she says it's not a crucified body that will save the world, but a glorified body. So Narad's advice to us is that the suffering will come, grief and anguish will find you out. Don't ask for that. But when it comes, be ready to bear it with the help, with the support of heaven's strength. No. Don't have that ambition.
Cipher.
A cipher is a, in this case, is a zero. Uh-huh.
Sort of slate of all this time.
Yeah, that's what small children learn to do, to draw ciphers on a slate when they are learning to do arithmetic. Zero number. So can you read, Dona Lakshmi?
Yeah. Two numbers is a venture for the living. Only in limits can man's strength be safe. Yet is infinity the spirit's goal. Its bliss is there behind the world's face of tears. The power is in thee that thou knowest not. Do part a vessel of the impressionate squad. It seeks relief from time's envelopment and will
Yeah, these passages are coming to you so that you can learn this one.
I learn, but I have some fixation of the let's eat in the silo display. Sorry, but I don't see it nicely.
Try to read to the end of the sentence.
Yeah. Bliss is a goddess crown. Eternal, free, unburdened by life's blind mystery of pain. Pain is a signature of the ignorance, attesting the secret God is denied by life. Until life finds in pain, can never.
Thank you. Sometimes I feel so overwhelmed by Sri Aurobindo's artistry, how he makes this transition from what he was saying about the Titan. And he says that's too soon, too enormous is that venture for thy will, you know, to become for mortal. Only in limits can man's strength be safe. That's what the Greeks always said, moderation in everything. It's what the Buddha said, the middle way. You know, only in limits can man's strength be safe. But then he says, yet is infinity thy spirit's goal. So our mortal part has to live in within limits, but our spirit is meant to widen to infinity. That is its goal. No? And its bliss is there behind the world's face of tears. That's what we can lean on, heaven's strength. No? A power is in thee that thou knowest not. No? Thou art a vessel of the imprisoned spark. Each of us is a vessel, a container of that imprisoned spark of infinity and eternity and bliss. And it's trying to get out. It's the soul, the imprisoned spark, wants to break out of this limitation of time and space and matter. And as long as we are insisting on or clinging to our individuality, we are shutting it in. And the seal, the mark of that, is pain. The pain comes actually to show us what we are doing, that we are clinging to our limits. where we feel pain, it's like, I think this is an aphorism of Sri Aurobindo, it's the finger of God showing you where you have to progress. I can't remember the exact words. So the seal is pain, but bliss is the Godhead's crown, eternal, free. It is unburdened by life's blind mystery of pain. Pain is the signature of the ignorance. If we're feeling pain, it's a sign that we are still in the ignorance. But it is attesting to, it's bearing witness to that secret God who wants to break out of the limits. That secret God who's denied by life. So until life finds him, pain can never end. It's the mark of this imprisonment and these limitations that we have to go beyond. So it's an amazing transitional passage from one theme to another. Murugan, would you read?
Come, self victory over the mentee, that thou shalt find at last thy road to bliss. Bliss is the secret stuff of all that is. Even pain and grief are
garbs
of world delight. It hides behind thy sorrow and thy pride, because thy strength is a part and not God's whole. Because afflicted by the little self, thy consciousness forgets to be divine. As it walks in the vague penumbra of the flesh and cannot bear the world's tremendous touch, thou
Christ
out and says that there is pain, indifference, pain and joy, a triple disgrace, a prayer of the rapturous dancer in the ways it holds from the body of God's bliss. Thy spirit strength shall make thee one with God, thy agony shall change to ecstasy, indifference deepen into infinity's calm, and joy love new on the peaks of the absolute.
So calm is like a first step, and endurance on the road to bliss. It's like a first step in the yoga. But we should know that bliss is the secret stuff of all that lives. From bliss we came, into bliss we go. That's where we have come from. That's what we shall experience ultimately. Even pain and grief are garbs, coverings, garments of world delight. They are forms which the world delight takes in us limited beings. That bliss is hiding behind thy sorrow and thy cry. Because we are limited beings, because our individual strength is only a part, a portion, and not the whole, no? Because we are afflicted by the little self that we've adopted for a particular lifetime, the true inner consciousness forgets to be divine. It becomes identified with this outer little self as it's walking here in the vague penumbra of the flesh, when we are wearing a mortal body, this shadowy substance. So we can't bear the tremendous touch of the world, all its challenges, no? So something comes, and then we cry out and say, oh, oh, pain. If then we can remember that pain and joy and indifference, this state that we are mostly in, are a triple disguise, the clothing of the rapturous dancer in the waves. There the Lord is dancing out his delight all the time. But these coverings, indifference, pain, and perhaps especially joy, are hiding from us the body of God's bliss. But if we can be calm and equal, then the Spirit's strength can bring us identification with the divine. And then even the intensest form of pain, agony, can turn to ecstasy. And that state of indifference can deepen into a very, very calm, steady state, the calm of infinity. And joy can laugh naked, nude on the peaks of the Absolute. We can experience the transcendent bliss. So beautiful. But this comes from bearing. Make of thy daily way a pilgrimage. For through small gift, joys and griefs, thou movest towards God. Calm is self's victory, overcoming fate. There thou shalt find at last thy road to bliss. But fear is our reaction to an imagination of suffering. No, we think something bad is going to happen. It's a kind of nature reaction.
So pain is a prelude, and fear comes from pain.
It comes from an anticipation of pain and suffering, no? No?
It's also a projection.
That's what I mean, it's a projection. We are afraid that we will suffer. Of course, when we feel pain, then we start fearing other things. We think, oh my God, what is it? No? Cancer. Heart attack. So then the fear of death comes in. But fear can take many other forms, and it's one of the ways that the lower forces get hold of us. It's through fear.
Look at it the other way around.
What?
Look at it the other way around.
Yes.
The pain comes from fear.
He says it comes from the limitation of our individual being. You know this poem about the scorpion, no? So here we are, we have this material body, and anything that attacks it, yeah, it's a danger sign. It's something dangerous to the integrality and the continuation of this mortal body and our individual self, which is being carried by it. So, but if we were open in consciousness to this delight of the rapturous dancer, so that's how he described it, now that he was walking on the terrace and the scorpion came and stung his foot, and the body cried out, felt it as pain. But he said the soul within felt the contact of the divine, and through the body's pain, it laughed, delighted.
What poem is this?
It's one of Schaubendorf's poems. It's in a, from a series of poems called The Meditations of Mandavya. Must be from the early, from the Arya time. And it's an experience that he had. But we, because we've experienced pain, we can fear it. The little child doesn't know that if it sticks its, or if it grabs hold of the light bulb, it will hurt, so it doesn't have fear then. But once it's felt it, then next time fear will prevent it doing it again.
And then maybe the other way is also true. When you have a mental conception about this is fearful, then it also comes a reaction in the body.
Yeah.
That is the other way.
I see that people are coming.
Yes.
They're conditioned to fear.
Yes. And these are subconscious things. These are things that are coming from the subconscious. So,
yes,
difficult to get rid of.
But in some experience, you don't have to have pain because of fear. In time, if you go in the dark, you won't feel pain. But if not pain, then you have fear.
It's fear of the unknown.
Yes, you don't want it.
So when you're going in the dark and you're afraid, you don't want fear. You don't want pain. But there's no pain. You just
there's an anticipation of something unpleasant. Foreboding. That's what the poem starts with. The huge foreboding mind of night.
Today we have a lot of fears because we are taught to have fear. Because in fear you can be manipulated. And you manipulate yourself. If you have fear for everything, just walking in the dark. Why? It's never as dark that you don't see anything. If you're confident, you will see things. You will hear things. You will smell things. Of course, if you walk in a dangerous area where are tigers and things, you are very careful. But there is nothing, this is not really where you have to have fear. You have to be careful.
And it doesn't depend entirely on our own individual experience. We are carrying with us this whole unconscious, subconscious apprehension, which has been building up in conscious matter since millions and millions of years through the experiences of so many bodies. So that's why it's not a very easy thing to get rid of.
Also, the surrounding where you are in is an influence. If I go here at night, I fear in the atmosphere the fear of all the villages of before. And if I walk in West Berlin in the darkest night, I have no fear yet. So that is something the surrounding also gives the impulses, no? And the kind of way how you perceive it.
Shall we move on? Maybe make a start on the next section. Because Narad says something very surprising. Larry, you would read it.
O mortal, who complainest of death and fate, accuse none of the harms thyself hast called. This troubled world thou hast chosen for thy home. Thou art thyself the author of thy opinion. Once in the immortal boundlessness of self, in a vast of truth and consciousness and life, the soul looked out from its felicity. it felt the spirit's interminableness. It knew itself deathless, timeless, spaceless, one. It saw the eternal, lived in the infinite. Then, curious of a shadow thrown by truth, it strained toward some otherness of self. It was drawn to an unknown face peering through night.
Thank you. Are we ready to accept this? That we have chosen all this, yes.
You know, this covered work we have chosen.
Did we
really choose ourselves?
That's what he's saying.
Yeah. For me, through my little experience, you know, I've been to everything.
But our soul, huh?
Our soul, yeah, the soul attracted, leaned towards the abyss. And you may remember we read in Life Divine that in fact all these accusations against the Creator, the Maker, that he has allowed all this, in fact all this pain and suffering is only acceptable if we think that the soul was given a choice. That we were asked, we were given the opportunity. Here, Narad describes it in a certain way, which Sri Aurobindo doesn't do in The Life Divine. But he says that in fact, this acceptance of involution, it can't have been imposed. It must have been an invitation. And perhaps not everybody accepted. Mother says the gods, they don't accept this invitation. No. They like to stay on their higher level. So if we are here, we've been given the invitation to participate in this adventure of manifestation and evolution. So he says, don't complain, don't accuse anybody. You have called this on yourself. You were attracted by this possibility in the soul. Mm. Yeah. I think if we look deep, we can see that it might be like
so
that.
Isn't it very brave, or is it a privilege for the soul to choose suffering?
Yes, choose difficulty, challenge. I think that's what Savitri says in the end, in the debate with death. Earth is the chosen place of heroic souls. And I know that I have seen an account that was sent to me of somebody who'd had a near-death experience. And this was what he had brought back with him. You know, that every ensouled or embodied being on Earth is a heroic soul. So it would be so wonderful if we could see it like that. No?
But could it also be the, you know, the titan or the ego that's attracted by, you know, the adventure of being power?
Well, probably there's also that aspect to it too.
Probably, yeah. It seems to say that the divine existence wanted to experiment some otherness
of self.
Very difficult because the divine being everything, how do you experiment otherness?
Yes.
But the only way was that somewhere would be created the opposite of it. And then you have a relation with something which is other.
Yes.
And the whole drama starts. And you go into it, re-emerge from it, but keeping the otherness. To find the unity again and the sense of otherness.
Exactly.
Together. And then there is a game.
Yeah. The play. Yeah. I've told this story before, those of you who have heard it before, forgive me. But there's a Vedantist, an American Vedantist in California, Alan Watts. And I remember it was a kind of one of these lights going on moment. He says, you know, if you are infinite, eternal, blissful, one, exactly what he says here, what are you going to do? You press the surprise button. Surprise me. So it's this otherness of self, something different. And of course, that explains the involution. Was it foreseen, the possibility, that if everything gets involved, it may not be able to evolve again? That's what's expressed in Mother's story. You know, that when the involution has happened, then the world is such a terrible thing of falsehood and darkness and death and suffering. Then the Supreme Mother turns to the Lord and says, look, Lord, what can we do about this? And then there's another descent, the descent of the first avatar of divine love, who's involved, who's completely covered up in all this darkness, and whose radiance is driving evolution. These are pictures, I mean, these are ways of possibly understanding. But Sri Aurobindo repeatedly tells us that the purpose of the manifestation is delight. No, it's meant to be enjoyed, really. That's why the bliss is there behind all the suffering.
What is this truth?
Some otherness of truth, a shadow thrown by truth. Truth is absolute light, not perfection. Truth, that's the way things are. But perhaps there's also another possibility, the possibility not only of pure existence, consciousness, and bliss, but the possibility of asat, of non-being, of darkness, of death and suffering. And Sri Aurobindo speaks about the avatar coming to woo the heart of the night. Now, the night is the opposite, the darkness. How can this night be won over, converted, turned back to light? That's the work, or the game, or whatever.
I think that these two lines before we had in the beginning of this part, lean for their soul support and heaven's strength, turn towards high truth, aspire to love and peace. No?
Yes.
That is always the orientation.
That's the way out. Mm. Medananda says the only way out is up. So let's stop there for today.
Titans hold, Against the law he pits his single will. Across its way he saws his pride of night. Heavenward he clambers on a stair of stone. Aspiring to live near the deathless sun.
Thanks to Shobindo.